Welcome to The Amplifiers, our new podcast here at A&M focused on innovators, disruptors, risk takers. And on today's show, we have Rob Roy. Rob and I have known each other for over a decade. He has a storied career. He's an entrepreneur that started in the retail space at Circus City. He also started an e-commerce business. He went on to work in the telecom space at Comcast, and then at Sprint, where he launched The Hive, a digital-first agency focused on driving more subscribers. And now he's part of T-Mobile and really has launched this brand new fiber business within T-Mobile. So welcome, Rob. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, man, I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to it. Love what you guys are up to. And it's exciting to talk about all these topics. And it's an exciting time in the industry right now.
Well, Rob, before we go into all that, I want you to tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? What sports did you play? How did you end up where you started your career at Circuit City? Tell me a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. So I bounced around when I was younger, up north on the East Coast, all on the East Coast, up north, finally landed in Virginia. Throughout kind of younger years, just all sorts of sports, probably couldn't be outside long enough, but settled in on swimming. And swimming as a distance swimmer, that probably helped set me up for some of the mental fortitude that maybe I have over time of, spending a lot of time on my head trying to figure things out and thinking things through. So I give a lot of credit to kind of that background, that distance swimming and kind of the, what that brought to my life. So how did I get to Circuit City? It was pure luck, which was awesome. I was late for class at JMU, and there was a sign up table for internships at Circuit City. And I went, oh man, Circuit City's in Richmond, Virginia. I'm in Richmond, Virginia. I need a job. So as I was running late to class, I signed up to get interviewed for a position there. They had, I think 600 applicants, 5 positions, 2 of which were web designers. And I think they, of the 600 or so people, I think only one, me, had a web design background at the time. So you think, 2001-ish, 2000, I had been doing a lot of different, kind of side gigs. I've been building websites on GeoCities, if you remember that, for small businesses way back in the day. And so I put that on the resume. They didn't have many people that could do web design, and e-commerce was so far, from line of sight at the time. I got an internship a couple weeks into it. They said, when you graduate, we'd love for you to come on. And that was an awesome experience because I got to learn e-commerce from every facet of the business. And one of my first mentors said to me was, learn everything you can. Don't be worried about moving up. Raise your hand for everything. And so, when I was doing web design, they needed a merchandise manager. I rose my hand and said, sure, I'll do merchandising. Do you know how to do merchandising? Nope, but I'll figure it out. Move along. We got new business development. Rose my hand. I'll take it. All the way up until the point where I was, eventually running the site. And was able to, pivot to the next thing. So, it was really formative for me to, really learn end to end, at the beginning of e-commerce, how everything works and how everything's stitched mm-hmm. together. And I've really leveraged that throughout my career, understanding how a simple thing like a promotion will affect, marketing or, inventory and logistics affects customer experience or customer care and everything in between and how it's all weaved together.
Yeah, it's interesting. Let's stick with Circuit City for a little bit because I'm just curious. I as a consultant, I worked for and served Circuit City and Best Buy. And I'm curious, just being on the inside there, I felt like the experience in the store was so much better than a lot of the other experiences at the time. What was it like? We were in chapter one of digital transformation. It was the early days. People weren't convinced any of this stuff would even work in that first chapter. You were on the ground building one of the first digital commerce capabilities around. So what was that like? What was the broader organization like? And any insights into as to why Best Buy made it and they didn't?
It's a fantastic question. One, you could potentially say they were too early, which in the world of technology, right? Sometimes you're too early, you miss it. We were omnichannel before that term was even existent. So my group invented the concept of buying online and picking up in store, right? You can think about that. You'd buy from your desktop. Mobile wasn't even really a thing, right? And you'd walk into the store, but the beauty of it was how seamless it worked from online to store. The associate really took over. You still can, you at the time, associates in those stores got comped for bigger sales. And so you would give them the comp. It worked seamlessly and interacted together. But culturally, we were still stuck in the early mid-90s. And how things worked. It always worked this way. It always worked that way. And so this was an uphill battle. And when it came down to it, you found a company that on one end of the spectrum had been in a significant disruptor. On the other end was beholden to traditional thoughts and feelings, leases that were no longer good leases, that the communities had moved beyond where the good footprint was. And so then you turned yourself into a mindset of cost-cutting initiatives. And with cost-cutting, in typical areas, spreadsheets you'd look at and say, here's the person I paid the most. Well, maybe we could save a few bucks by getting rid of that. Well, what you just said was it was amazing. Great customer experience, great people, good salespeople. Well, you walked into those stores and all of a sudden those people were no longer there, and we made decisions. And so no matter how good the technology is, how good the experience of those technologies can be, if you don't have the culture behind you, if you don't have the foundation of the building blocks to make all of those things work well within the ecosystem, it may not survive. And that was one of those things that it was a sad story to see, but it was crazy to see real time and kind of watch that happen. When you look back, you're like, oh yeah, that's kind of obvious. But in the time when however many consultants are there looking at the books and saying, hey, if we just cut this much millions, we'd be fine. But you don't really understand the effect that it has on the culture, the effect that it has on the consumer.
Yeah, no, you're right, and it's whenever you're reducing cost or optimizing, it's always a balance of how do you cut to a certain point, but below that point you get into a death spiral and the business, can't be successful. So there's always that there's this like little precision as to what you can do and what you can't, because it reminds me of the time. Remember I when you launched the Hive at Sprint, I remember we were on the ground and we couldn't find a trash can. And someone had said that a third party had come in and said, cut all the trash cans out of the office or whatever. What do you think? Like, is there one reason you feel, or was it a couple of reasons why Circuit City just didn't make it? Was there something glaring that or obvious and Best Buy did?
If you look back and you see a champion challenger model, and I think this works across any sector, Circuit City was the champion for so long, and they just looked forward. They forgot to look back. And as a challenger, you're constantly looking up and forward at the next thing, the next step. And I think Best Buy was hungrier. I think Best Buy, they took opportunistic shots. Oh, you don't want this piece of property? We'll take the lease. We've got to, we're where the consumer wants to be. They pivoted to smaller footprint stores before anyone else, right? Like you think about back in 01 to 08, like these massive big boxes, right? You know, you'd walk into a massive Sears, you'd walk into, a Big Lots, a Circuit City or whatever. Like these were just enormous stores. Like they had to fit those 80-inch projection screen TVs into them. So these were just massive stores. You know, Best Buy, they probably credited with hitting on first, some of the first, smaller format stores. And they made those pivots quicker. They got to the consumer. They got to what the consumer wanted before the consumer knew they wanted it. And Circuit City kept servicing the consumer as they expected to be serviced and forgot that at some point in time, there was going to be that pivot to the next expectation, right? You look at even today, these digital disruptors and how the experience you have with, say, an Amazon and a one-click order. If you walk into a store and there is a wall between you and trying to purchase something, the next time you go to purchase that thing, you may go through Amazon versus that store because your expectation has now been set by a digital disruptor in the real world. And I think you can look at that in a champion challenger model anytime. If the champion becomes complacent and forgets that they need to continue to innovate and be ahead of the curve, then eventually they'll become the challenger or worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes a lot of sense. And it's interesting because whenever I walk into a store, I always think, is this an omni-channel play, or can you do this fully through digital commerce and fulfillment, UPS, FedEx fulfillment? And in certain cases you can, in others you can't. And when you have that physical presence today, the reality is you don't need the inventory. You don't need to have that inventory sitting on those shelves the way you may have had back in the mid-90s. When you left, do you feel like you went from Circuit City to, and you had your own commerce business, and one of the things that I noticed across your career, and this is just me observing you over time as we've gotten to know each other better, is that you became, kind of an expert in digital marketing, in digital commerce, and in building amazing teams that were able to do that better than consultancies, than agencies, than anybody. Where did you find, did you have a mentor? How did you figure that out?
Yeah.
And was it a combo of Circuit City and your e-commerce startup, or how did you get to the point where you knew that or understood that?
Yeah. So I'm thinking back to a moment that delights me and at the same time still drives me. So Circuit City, yes. It's one hand, we talked about this earlier, just learning every end-to-end part of the business. I love sitting with my developers now, and I love to tell them I can call BS on certain things because I've been there, done that. So I understand. So when I go and talk to groups, when I go and hire for groups, I can understand better what they're thinking, how they're thinking, how they see the business, why they see the business. But more importantly, the importance of understanding the full business. Why are you coding this? Why are you coding that? Why is this project the most important project versus, project 10 on my list or whatever? To understand that is powerful. To have an organization understand that it's a championship team ready to happen. And so I've tried to really take that and build teams that work really well together and understand the need of the business, so we're all rowing in the same direction. I've made mistakes over my career where I've found people that are just beyond A players, and they do not fit in the organization for whatever reason, right? Maybe they're, bad attitude, maybe they're a solo or whatever. And I made a mistake once where I kept someone around because I felt like the value of the work was too great, and overtook maybe some of the softer traits that you needed to create a team that worked well together. And I have not made that mistake since. And so that's always been important to me. It's a people first business. I don't go into the, it's a family. You gotta, feel like, look, it is a business at the end of the day. We all gotta work together. We gotta enjoy working together, and that's important. But everyone's gotta be there for the same goal, to wanna drive to a certain outcome. And so I've really focused on that. And then just a funny anecdote to that around Circuit City. My first mentor, who actually was my boss, he was the GM of CircuitCity.com, gave me my first opportunity to be a manager. And going from a SME to a manager is a big step. You're used to doing everything on your own. You're given a task, you knock out the task, you move on, take the next task. Manager is a whole different game, right? You've got to take 10, 12, 15, however many SMEs, and get them to work together and maximize the output of that particular team, but also, maximize the output of the rest of the organization. And I kept acting like a SME. And I would take on tasks that other people should have been doing within my team. I wasn't doing a very good job delegating any of these things. And my boss, my mentor, he said, "You know what? I'm moving your desk." I was like, "All right, the whole team's moving." He goes, "No, I'm moving your desk." And he kept the whole team together, and he moved me 2 floors up into the furthest part of the building. And so it was literally like, no way, unless I'm down there kind of like, meandering around, that would be obvious. Well, I spent 5.5 weeks there, sulking probably, and learning a very valuable lesson that one is much less important than the whole. And so I've taken that with me the whole time. As I promote people, I explain to them that the job they were doing is valuable, but they now have a new job, and they need to find the next person to do the job they were doing, and they need to focus on their job. And so, having that experience and taking that with me throughout, whether it was my startup that I did, or even today, I find those valuable lessons.
What was the hardest thing about making a transition? If you think about startup, and then you had your experience in retail, and then the startup was in retail, what was hard about that?
Look, in a big business, you can cover up mistakes. Mistakes can be forgotten. Mistakes can be shoved off to the side. You can, it's not the most pressing thing, so maybe your update gets forgotten that week or what have you. You can kind of slide through things if you're in a rough patch. If you don't make payroll, or you don't get that enhancement out, or a sale doesn't come in when you're in a startup, you know it because it's on your face, and then everyone else that's working with you knows it because it's on your face. And so I thought that was a really great lesson too, as I've moved back into bigger organizations, that I like to run my organization like a startup within that bigger organization. I don't want to fall to the shadows of things. It needs to be that if we're going to go do something special within a big organization, we got to be treated like the BAU. We've got to be treated like the bigger organization, because you need to get those eyeballs on you. You need to get those resources at some time. But it's a delicate balance. But yeah, it was an interesting time, especially when things were a little bumpy.
Yeah, I mean, I can't I remember the first time. In the early days of one of my startups, I had to make payroll, and I had no money in the bank, and wasn't sure where the money was going to come from. And that's the one big difference. Like, when you have to make payroll in a startup, and that's the one big difference between that and a larger company. But it gives you a perspective that very few people have,
That's right.
and you're outside of your comfort zone, which I think is just amazing. When you so you had the you have these experiences in retail and e-commerce, you're building your digital it your skills and your ability to lead a team. Out of the retail experiences, was there one that stood out that where you're like, I will probably never have a CEO that I work for that's like this individual or a team or what, or be in this type of situation again.
So non-telecom, so my two retail experiences. The amazing part of when we were working at Circuit City and building that business, you know, you went from you sold $1 million in a year to $1 billion in sales in a year. Like that rocket ship, like that was like a 3 year, 4 year turn. To see, you know, different celebrities buying their, you know, five or six TVs online and having them shipped out, and everyone running around high-fiving about that thing, to really creating what it was to modern day purchase online. My startup, you know, designed the concept of saved carts. You know, so you go on, you save your grocery list, it's there. You could come back next week and repurchase it. That seems like a pretty normal thing to do today, right? And so having those memories and those understandings that this industry was built on concepts and thoughts and failures that today feel normal, you know, just normal. Yeah, I do that. You know, I looked at my Amazon, you know, this morning when I was out of espresso pods. Click, done. When I did that in 2009, I went, "Whoa, that was awesome." So carrying those experiences with me, I know we'll get into this, but especially into the kind of the turn that we're in right now with AI, it reminds me of all the stuff we're hearing now are all the failures and some of the successes that we're going to become commonplace tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's unique about your experience, you have gone, you know, there's been three chapters of digital transformation. Chapter one was digital marketing, commerce, and, you know, Google is probably, and Amazon are probably the best representations of that. Chapter
Sure.
two is cloud and all the cloud services with Adobe and others. And then chapter three was AI. And so you've gone through all those. You know, when you made the pivot to the telecommunications industry and cable, you were entering kind of chapter two. Tell us a little bit about that. What was that like? How was telco different than retail?
When I first started, I'm not sure many of the telcos even knew digital was still around or was a thing. You know, it was still a time where you would call in and get your service, or you'd have a guy knock on your door, a gal knock on your door, and you'd say, "Hey, I'm ready to switch," or maybe even worse, "Here's the service you get because that's the only one that's at your house." And so this, you know, during that time, it was an evolution from not only really doing, you know, normal tasks, let's say banking and stuff like that online, but the evolution of M commerce, right? So the whole M dot evolution. And you know, it's gonna be the next big thing. You know, and everything that came with it. It was what was really exciting about that arc was that because telcos weren't good at a lot of the foundational items, again, I got the pleasure to try things out. I got the rope, if you will, to go and disrupt and think about things differently. It gave them, for the first time in a lot of cases, the opportunity to you know, take old legacy systems and start to consolidate them down, which then becomes a cost savings, which then increases revenue, which then you can go pour back into to other things. And so it was that was an exciting time, maybe for a bit of a different reason, because you started to see digital or e-commerce and traditional IT start to come together. It used to be that the business would toss some thoughts over the wall to IT. 8, 10 months later, IT would come back with something totally different, not what was needed, and then go back at it again. And now it started to become closer and closer. These new systems, these CRMs, you know, all of the systems that power the websites would start to converge with all the legacy billers, start to make, you know, tasks a little bit simpler, start to, you know, validate and understand the consumer that you're actually paying, you're actually working with. And so that was a lot of fun. And that carried on. You know, probably once those foundations of legacy systems started to update, then the thinking around, well, what does that now mean for marketing? What does that now mean for, the way that we, we digital, how we market in general, 360 customer understandings and all of those things.
And, I want to take a step up on the broader telecom space. There's been some changes that have occurred that are significant, right? I mean, I remember in 2010 when I started working at Verizon, everybody was convinced it was a combination of content plus the network. And so there was the whole play for media. And AT&T went at it in a big way. Verizon followed with its own kind of acquisitions and, AOL and all those elements, and Yahoo. And basically then at some point, everyone realized, hey, we can't be the best at optimizing the network if we're doing all these other things too. And so then there was the decoupling, which kind of started with Elliott Management jumping in at AT&T. What's your take? I mean, we had that. Do you have any thoughts on that broader market and where we are now and kind of how this is going to evolve? We just saw Frontier purchased by Verizon. So there's a consolidation in the fiber space. What's your take on the broader space?
So generally, what I'd say is that the consumption and need for connectivity, the amount of devices online, the time that you're online, I like to call it the always connected consumer. That in early days wasn't as important before, we really had mobility at its finest. Now everything's connected. And so, really thinking about how to revolutionize the networks and having and owning the arteries that deliver all the connectivity is going to become so much more important as we look to kind of the evolution of the industry. And I think what's going to end up happening is the providers are going to really want to focus on the tools that will continue to enhance those networks and the connectivity, as well as expand the connectivity and the network within itself, and stop thinking about the content and the media convergence that kind of fizzled out, if you will. You see even cable backing out of video to a degree and looking at what OTT services there are, and they're really starting to hone in on what are the services that are going to create a better experience for my customers. And that's going to be the connectivity, the end-to-end connectivity, the always connected consumer. And so really focusing on those things, if you can build the right experience and the right network and have the right visibility, then you can start to, think about, what does that mean for like a connected city? What does that mean for IoT or Internet of Things? What does that mean for, kind of the rise of autonomous and, how AI plays within, the expansion and self-healing of a network and all of those things.
That's really interesting, Rob. And I mean, you and I met about a decade ago. I can remember it to this day. I think we met at an incubator.
That's right.
In Crystal City, now known as National Landing. And, the first thought I had was, wow, this guy really understands how to build a digital first business. And at that point, you had gone from Comcast to right. Sprint, which was at the time owned by private equity. It was owned by SoftBank and Masa-san and that whole crew. And so that's you and you were in chapter two. Your job was to make them digital first, like some of the European providers. What was that like, that transition?
No, I mean, I think it was incredible. It was awesome because to be given an opportunity to take an incumbent who is now getting pressured by the world of digital adopters and digital experiences, and having to transform not only the experiences, but the company into a data-driven, digital-first, AI-enabled vision of what it could be. None of those things strung together at that time. And when we sat down and we talked about that concept and that idea and how that may happen, go back to one of my comments before, is like I realized early on that digital transformation does not work unless the whole entire company is behind it. And so you helped me put together that right format and that right set of structures to make sure that from the top down, we were all thinking about it in the same exact way and creating that enablement. And, you know, one of the best compliments I've ever gotten in my entire life was when we were sitting in a board meeting and the head of care started talking about, unprompted, started talking about some of the programs that we had enabled for her, like they were her own. And someone reached over and goes, that was your stuff. And I went, it is still our stuff. But it's amazing that someone else is presenting it for me, because that shows how passionate they are about that particular program. And it means that it's now entwined within the culture. And that was really what we were trying to do. We were trying to make everyone feel like they were part of that digital transformation. And that's when it becomes real. If you have the whole organization fighting against you, then you have a group of passionate digital-first people that want to make a difference, that probably know how to make a difference. But you can't change culture, and you can't change, excuse me, you can't change process without first changing culture. And so that's what we really focused on when I was given that opportunity was, okay, how can we change the culture so that we can then go change the process?
And I mean, I remember being there, along the ride for the journey that you went on, and you dramatically improved results. So, whether it was digitally acquired subscribers, digital fulfillment, there were some key metrics that you judged the digital business by, which were dramatically better over a couple of years that you were driving that.
I mean, over our peer set, we were well above and beyond. And, you know, this was even, you know, pre-pandemic, before things, you know, in a good way, if you want to take some good out of that, were forced to go digital, and forced to change the way that they do things. You know, telemed is one of those things that comes to my mind, very quickly. But, to come into a business where less than 1% of the sales were happening digitally in a very complex industry of, you know, buying and selling cell phones, to leave, when that when we merged with T-Mobile, it was plus 20% of sales in a very short period of time, showed what the power of, you know, having a having kind of an omni-channel strategy that would blend really the online and offline experiences and really create a new norm. And we were just at the cusp. We were just at the cusp of the time of really then putting that little added layer cake of AI predictability into the customer behavior and tailoring those shopping experiences. So, you know, it was really all about redefining digital disruption through, you know, the power of recommendation, the power of a blended online and offline experience. And that was exciting to see, because it was all enabled by the fact that the full company, the full business was behind it, was driving for it. They wanted it.
And I mean, what's amazing to me is, like, a lot of times someone will put a did an organization will put a digital strategy plan together. We're going to become a digital first mobile carrier, and the reality sets in that it's not really about the why and the what, but when you get to the how, you know, how you and what was really impressive to me is you did three things that I thought were amazing. You branded the organization the Hive. You redid the office space. I think you brought another SoftBank portfolio company we work in to rethink what the office felt like and the culture and everything else. The second thing I saw that I was really impressed with is you were able to recruit amazing talent that was, there were people that I'd worked with in startups I would have never expected to go into a large organization. They were sitting there in your organization. And the third thing I noticed was that you created an environment where everyone from the CEO on down was vested in the success of this digital pivot. And you had weekly calls with the CEO and his direct reports. There was almost a continuous communication and buy-in, and he was ready to tackle any kind of challenges that you ran into. And that was amazing. I thought that was an amazing kind of run and something that was very unique that you did.
Yeah, coupled with the fact that we were constantly under rumors of either bankruptcy or being bought, to be able to grab the talent. But it started with, that high vision, the idea, the concept, and getting behind something. It was a startup within the larger company. And that then, that grew beyond what I even thought would ever happen. I mean, we started having, people in finance using our backgrounds as part of their presentations. We obviously, I told the story about care and stuff like that, but the digital disruptors, the digital first folks that we brought in could see it, could feel it, could touch it. They could get it from a startup, but maybe they want to try something different. They had never seen it happen in a big business. And so the risk was for them, I always joke that the risk for them was it didn't work out. And they were, 2 weeks later, they're on to the next job. They were that good. And so it was exciting to see throughout the experience. I don't think we had anybody leave. Everyone kept to the tasks. They really enjoyed it. And it was a wonderful run and laid a great foundation for the merger as well.
And then the merger happened. You go to T-Mobile, and I would argue that one of the big reasons was everything you created on the digital front. And you go to T-Mobile, and you make a little bit of a pivot to new businesses. You're like, hey, there's a ton of undervalued assets here that we can turn into new companies, digital services, and we can take those and create adjacent digital first businesses that that take the market. What was that like? Was the T-Mobile leadership on board with that? Did you face headwinds?
That's a great question. I think the answer is you're always going to find headwinds when you are starting a business and you have a company that's an incumbent that has a good solid revenue flow that probably hasn't hit its maturation yet. You're continuing to see. And so the best companies invest before they have to, before it is a problem, before they need to. And so very much to the leadership's credit, investing before we have to and getting it ready and growing. I mean, the tech industry in general, it's at a pivotal moment. It's evolving way faster than it has ever been before. Daily you're getting, news and breakthroughs of AI. There's increased connectivity, widespread adoption of digital tools across every single sector. And you're seeing these profound changes in how the industry operates. And I believe it'll continue that way. You'll see a decade of transformation and innovation. And so my pitch was really about how do we get at the forefront of that? How do we continue to really press forward and be at the front of this wave, leveraging all of the different tools and assets, and continue to allow our bigger businesses to run as they needed to run? And we've seen a lot of success in doing so.
For other people that are trying to get into the innovation game and, kind of take assets inside the business and and launch new businesses. I mean, what were a couple of thoughts on what made you successful in that role, and then how that became T-Fiber and the whole fiber initiative?
You know, I think first and foremost, you do have to have the vision. You got to have a plan, and you probably have to have a fairly decent amount of thick skin. And I like to say, you know, leaders have to lead. If you go and knock on a door and you hear no, and you go back into, you know, whatever corner and you start, you know, muddling around, and it becomes an incubator, or it's an innovation center, or it's one of these things that usually is one of the first things on the consultant list of, like, there may be some opportunity here because it's not core to the business, type side of the spreadsheet, then that's where you're going to end up. The individuals that are successful at creating new businesses that will be accretive to the overall business are ones that don't give up. They don't take no for an answer. If they hear a no from one, they go to the next one. They keep knocking on doors, because inherently the culture is whatever the culture is, but it's not your new thing. It's whatever they're used to. It's their daily stand-ups. It's the BAU motion of that particular business. And by definition, you're coming in and you're trying to change that. Whether it's taking IT resources, whether it's taking marketing resources, whether it's standing up your own little thing where you've got a bunch of other managers saying, "How come you've got jobs like my jobs?" You're going to get pressure from everywhere. And if you can push past that pressure, the irony of it is the next phase within the organization is people that want to help you. Everybody wants to be part of it. Everybody wants to come in. Everybody wants to have an opinion on it. And at that point, you have to find the balance of welcoming all of those new thoughts with the continued motion of making sure that it moves forward at the pace of innovation or at the pace of the customer experience. That's where second phase innovation can die, or transformation can die. It gets swallowed up by the big thing. One of my, you know, I don't want to say pet peeves, but one of my problems, one of the things I look out for is it's very easy to create pilots. It's very hard for those pilots to become bigger pieces of the business. Pilots can be shown as very successful because they're kind of in self-contained, you know, self-contained areas. Maybe it's a one-off, it's done in a non-traditional motion or process. To then take a successful pilot and be able to expand it into a larger, you know, company-wide initiative, it's not nearly impossible, but it's hard. And it takes a different person. It takes a different mindset. It takes a different drive. And all of these things, you know, they work against you when you're trying to do something new at every turn, whether it's finance saying, "I need a 5-year projection." It's like, "I haven't had my first sale. How am I possibly going to get you a 5-year projection?" Or worse, they may want to know how many sales you're going to do on a Tuesday. You know, that's these are real conversations that I have, you know, on a daily basis. Or it's the marketing folks saying, "Well, we're pretty sure we know how to do this thing because we do it, you know, in mass this way." Well, no, this is a different business. This is, and it's teaching, and it's bringing along folks that are not necessarily used to it. And again, making them feel part of the process, but also not allowing it to get swallowed into the process.
It's interesting you say that. And the reason I've been in so many kind of leadership meetings at different companies that are looking to create adjacencies, where someone from the existing business basically is saying, "Hey, if we," and this is actually something that happened, "if we invest in a coal, in our existing coal-fired power plant and make improvements, we're going to make more money than if we get into renewable energy," for example. That actually happened in a leadership meeting that I sat in on. But I think it is, you're right, because everything inside of the existing S-curve business is designed, they're antibodies that are designed to promote the bigger business. Kodak was the first company to build a digital camera. They didn't monetize that because the S-curve, everything was invested into the existing business. And your example of a forecast is a perfect one. How can you do a 5-year forecast if you're just starting a new business? It's almost
Exactly.
impossible.
Exactly.
But well, so to talk. I know we're short on time here. Talk about T-Mobile Fiber, T-Fiber. You guys have gotten a lot of press lately, especially with this, Nick's sale of Frontier
Yep.
to the team at Verizon. What? How did you make? How were you able to get that to get escape velocity and start to
Yeah.
scale?
Yeah, I mean, so one, we have an amazing customer base. Absolutely amazing, very loyal T-Mobile customers. And the loyalty is rooted in we do what we say, no nonsense. We tell you the price is the price. It's locked. We don't change things on you. We do, what we call the Un-carrier approach to things. And cable has traditionally been very slow to make changes. They have a different model, a model that's rooted in, fees and other things. And so when we started our original fixed wireless approach, we took that Un-carrier approach and tried to, un-cable broadband. We then said, this is working really well. People are enjoying the product. And I set out to create a similar model to what Europe has that the US had not seen, which is wholesale relationships. We would go out and look for people that were really good at building fiber because we were really good at marketing and customer love and customer satisfaction. And so we created these relationships to go kind of dip our toe, test the waters, if you will. I had the luxury of doing it on a greenfield system as well. So we got to create our own system. We did it in a way that we could learn. Every time we launched a new home, we learned about that experience. We improved all the customer touch points, everything that they could do. We started out with, you don't have to call care because we're giving you all the tools. Anything that you'd want to do, you can do yourself, right down to canceling. And it was just different, right? You call and try to cancel with one of the big guys. They're going to send you to a retention center and explain to you why that's not a good idea. We stand on the service. We told you were going to get whatever, a gig service. You get your gig. If you don't like what you're getting, you can go into the app, hit the button, and you can disconnect. But we feel strongly that we've created an experience that they're not going to want to do that. But we did it in a way that, we created a platform, we created an experience, and we learned from it. And that gave way to showing that there was the next phase, the next step. And that's what we just took. We announced JVs with both Lumos and Metronet, which we're extremely excited about.
I saw
And that's
that.
going to make,
Congratulations.
yeah, thank you. Thank you. That's going to make way for the next wave, the next evolution. And so we're trying to do what T-Mobile has done for years in the Un-carrier of wireless, we're doing to broadband today, and we're excited about that.
What you've done at T-Mobile with T-Fiber is absolutely amazing. And it's kind of it's the dream of taking those assets like marketing, a really strong marketing engine, and then monetizing them in different ways. And I think it's been impressive to watch you do that. I was going to ask you one more question, and then we can close up. I know we're close to the end of the time here.
Sure.
What about what do you do for fun? What's outside of work? What do you like doing?
Oh man. I love hanging out with the family. Now my kids are getting old enough, which is crazy because I met you probably before, right at kids, first kid at least. Now we got sports jam-packed every weekend. So going and watching them, have fun and play around, goofing off. I tweaked my back this weekend, just, doing gymnastics moves with my 7-year-old daughter that I shouldn't have been doing as an old man. So I enjoy just hanging out with them. And then I would say if it's a day of the week, you may find me out smoking some sort of meat as well, barbecue. And I tend to enjoy that. So and I think my son's gotten the itch for that too. So you'll find us out there smoking ribs or something like that as well.
And you're a golfer.
Yeah. I try. I try. These two JVs that we just did have really affected my handicap, but I tend to get out of it when I can.
Well, that's awesome. Well, Rob, this has been awesome. I appreciate you taking time to talk with me. You've had an amazing career. I've been kind of watching, observing, learning from you. Three things that I've learned today, most importantly. The first is, I think, resilience, which is no matter how tough it gets, when you're starting new businesses inside of bigger companies, you got to have a thick skin and you got to keep going. And everything is kind of written in pencil until you get escape velocity. So I think that's one. Two, focus on building skills and learning something that's very differentiated. And you did that at the beginning of the digital revolution and became an expert in building digital first businesses. And the third thing, which I've observed over a decade, is humility. You have confidence, you're persistent, but you're humble about all the things you've achieved. So those are my three things for today. I appreciate your time, and look forward to many more conversations, my friend.
I appreciate it, man. It's always good to see you and always good to hang out. It's a great conversation. So I can't thank you enough for having me.